Vous écoutez en balado-diffusion le colloque Saving Freedom in an Age of Diversity, James Tully's Public Philosophy, présenté par le groupe de recherche sur les sociétés plurinationales. Deuxième épisode, conférence de Michael Temelini, Tully's Dialogical Approach to Political Science.
It's a great privilege to be here this afternoon and participate in this conference amongst such distinguished scholars, some of whom are my former classmates. It's really nice to see Cressida again and Dale, who I haven't seen since I don't even want to mention when.
I already mentioned.
We're here to honor the work of Jim Tully, and I want to take this opportunity before I forget to actually congratulate him, because he's told us that he's retiring from teaching, which I find quite shocking. So I want to congratulate him on many years of teaching. And in a lot of ways, my talk today is going to be reflective of some of the things he taught me, taught us. One of the things he taught me was a way of thinking about politics that's influenced me throughout my academic career and my involvement in different political movements. So I'm very happy to be here to share my thoughts with you. First thing is, it's true that Jim is a renowned scholar and writer, but one of the things I want to emphasize is that he's also an award-winning teacher. And like some others in this room, I was very lucky to have Jim as a teacher. And something I want to emphasize today is that this aspect of his work, his teaching, shouldn't be neglected. His approach to teaching actually shows insights into something I want to talk about today, which is his concept of dialogue in public philosophy. So I'm not just going to talk about Jim's writing, but some of the things he imparted to us as a teacher. When I first met Jim a long time ago, in 1986, he was already well known for his exquisite work on Locke and his early writings like A Discourse on Property. Jim focused his attention primarily on classic and lesser-known texts without, of course, ignoring the traditions of interpretation that informed these texts and concepts. His idea in these early writings was that you have to examine these texts in the context of the practical struggles, linguistic conventions and practices and institutions that informed them. His courses in those early years were among the most popular at McGill Political Science, and it's not really hard to explain why. As grad students, we were always so impressed with the tremendous sensitivity and care that Jim expressed with regards to these classic and less known texts. And it's no exaggeration to say that Jim Tully actually taught a generation of young Canadians and not so young Canadians how to read, frankly. The other thing that was really remarkable about Jim, which is something I'm going to be emphasizing today, is that he was an excellent public speaker. He had this and has this amazing ability to explain incredibly complex philosophical ideas in a way that was quite accessible. Since the publication of Strange Multiplicity, Jim's work, the nuance of Jim's work shifted towards diverse political struggles over recognition, while not ignoring, of course, the texts and concepts that inform them. Now, his argument all along has been that the problems of political theorists should address are not theoretical problems. The problems should be the practical problems given to them by the age in which they live in. And in that spirit, I don't want to talk today about any particular theoretical issues that Jim's work gives rise to. I told the organizers that I've been doing a lot of work on Wittgenstein and the influence of Wittgenstein in Jim's work. But what I want to talk about today are the practical implications of some of his writing and his teaching. And the thing I want to talk about in particular is the way we practice the discipline of political science, and we could say the social sciences in general, more broadly. I want to explore how Jim's concept of dialogue and public philosophy calls into question some fundamental ways in which we typically think about political science, the way we teach political science, the way we practice political science. And like Cressida, I want to begin with an anecdote and a quote. When I was a grad student at McGill, I was fortunate enough to participate in a number of Jim seminars. And after one class, and I've never forgotten this, I approached Jim and I thanked him for that class. And I said something like, I can't remember, you know, something like, I learned a lot today. You know, thank you, I learned a lot today. And the reason why I remember his response was because it startled me. What he said to me was, I did too. Now, at the time, I remember thinking what a kind and encouraging thing it is to say, but surely this could not possibly be correct. How could this eminent scholar, clearly the political theory expert, clearly our intellectual superior, what could he possibly learn from a bunch of grad students? And it took me many years, excuse me, before I understood that he wasn't just trying to be a nice guy, but completely sincere. The anecdote illustrates, as far as I'm concerned, his approach to politics, the way he teaches politics, with the way he describes what he describes as a dialogical approach and an aspectival approach, and what we can also call public philosophy. I want to begin to unravel some of these concepts. And I'll begin with the same quote that Cressida cited. Maybe I don't have to say it because she already did. The first question of political philosophy today, or political science, is how do we attend to the strange multiplicity of voices and activities without distorting or disqualifying them in the very way we approach them? The answer he gives is to enter into dialogues with the wider range, wider audience of citizens who are engaged in civic struggles and not prejudge them. The key to this argument is a contrast between two approaches. One is a dialogical aspectival approach. The other is a monological finality-oriented approach. In a nutshell, political science is typically understood in a monological and finality-oriented way. And Jim's argument is essentially that whether we call it political science, political philosophy, political thought, political theory, the study of politics is dialogical. And since there's countless ways of studying politics and no universal criteria to adjudicate its diversity, politics is an open-ended dialogue. So Jim's work essentially contrasts these two concepts of monologue and dialogue. And I'm going to assume that you have some familiarity with the term, so I'll try to be very brief with my summary. A monological orientation, he tells us, is a style of moral and political reasoning that exhibits two related tendencies. One is imposition, the other is finality orientation. A monological approach is a one-sided and elitist approach in which any speaker preemptively imposes the terms of discussion or point of view without even trying to listen what other people are actually saying in their own terms in particular cases. This monological imposition, he tells us, goes hand in hand with a tendency that Wittgenstein called our craving for generality and the contemptuous attitude towards the particular case. This compels us to find a common element among all the cases under examination and neglect the particular aspects. Now, the contempt for particularity, the craving for generality, takes a lot of different forms. More robustly, you can see it as an epistemological imperative to look for something timeless or universal that can be formulated in a rule or a law that covers every case. But this contempt also is exhibited in another tendency, which is to assign priority and privilege to any theory as the essential source of explanation. So the imperative of a theoretical approach is to develop a general framework, determine how to apply it in particular cases. And what counts as a sound explanation in this sense is necessarily comes from the correct application of the theory. So he describes monologue in this sense as a preconceived idea to which reality must correspond. It's a method in which the practices of one side are evaluated within the ready-made framework of the other. It takes for granted that we should translate, re-describe, reinterpret, or comprehend self-descriptions into preset, general, universal, transcendental, culturally invariant, implicit, comprehensive, or theoretical languages categories or rules. The other tendency of monologue is finality orientation. It assumes that there's some definitive or final procedures or solutions or end states that we should all live with once the conversations are finished. And in fact, that normal life can continue outside of the conversation. Now, the alternative to that monological approach is a dialogical and aspectival approach. While monologue imposes and defines, the dialogical approach promotes explanations and understandings and political solutions that are imperfect, partial, provisional, and defeasible, which is to say that they're always open to negotiation and reconsideration. Now, this approach is based on two lines of Wittgenstein's famous anti-essentialist argument. First argument, meaning is use. The second argument is that use is irreducibly tangled, diverse, and contested. So understanding the meaning of a concept doesn't come from the theoretical activity of applying a general theory or rule, but a practical ability to use concepts to give reasons and explanations why they should or should not be used in different and particular ways and in various circumstances and contexts. This assumes that we must avoid the craving for any set of rules or theories that somehow are abstracted from practice. That is also to say that political practices cannot be reduced to things like mathematical formulas or general theories or causally contingent variables because, as Jim puts it, the multiplicity of uses is too various to be governed by rules. Rather than looking for a rule or a formula, instead, we should compare the various examples to see if there are any family resemblances and survey what Wittgenstein called in the Philosophical Investigations the complicated network of similarities, overlapping, and crisscrossing. So, there's a third aspect of dialogue that I want to emphasize, which is that, and this is something that Jim articulates very forcefully in his two volumes, Philosophical, his latest publication, which is to say that dialogue implies that having a say is an inalienable freedom, and that reasonable disagreement is a normal and inevitable aspect of everyday life. Reasonable disagreement is what he calls a dialogical civic freedom. And that freedom is correlated with a duty. The duty is for the powerful to listen and respond. If the duty is ignored, then freedom takes the form of dissent. Since reasonable disagreement is inevitable and inalienable and unavoidable, the primary aim of politics should be to promote the duty to listen and to protect the freedom to disagree. So if there is a responsibility to protect, it's the responsibility to protect and guarantee free, unobstructed participation in practices of negotiation and to foster reasonable disagreement. So dialogue entails talking with participants actually engaged in political practices, listening to the content and to the way in which they express themselves, including their self-descriptions in the explanation, and allowing for disagreement with the explanation and any proposed solutions to their struggles. An important part of this argument, Jim tells us, is that democratic dialogue is not something that should happen, but dialogical negotiation is something that already constitutes the everyday real world of politics. Dialogue is actual. The problem is that it's often overlooked and sometimes deliberately overridden by very powerful actors. And in particular, the monological tendency that he highlights is typically evident among theorists, courts, and policymakers who, as he puts it, force their top-down interpretations, explanations, decisions, solutions, and rules or institutions without any regard to diversity awareness, without democratic input from citizens, by forcing citizens to deliberate within already made or predetermined languages, or by subverting the or undermining the everyday ordinary practices of democratic dialogue. I think a really good illustration of what he's talking about is this so-called Quebec Charter of Values. Now, among other reasons why we should object to that charter, the biggest mistake that charter makes, or would make, would be to, through legislation, statutorily outlaw negotiated compromise, the very successful, ordinary, commonplace, everyday practices of intercultural, interfaith, reconciliation that always already happens in Quebec. What the charter would do is shut that down, which is why I think Jim's idea that dialogue is deliberately overridden is critically important. In the social science and humanities, monological practices flourish. But the discipline of political science is singled out in particular as a repeat offender. The normal approaches to political science make it elitist and monological because, in simple terms, political science is held captive by the craving for generality, and it exhibits contempt for what seems the less general. Normally, political scientists do not enter into dialogues with a wider audience of citizens. There are exceptions, of course, and we can recognize the exceptions. What I'm talking about, and I think what Jim is talking about, are the normal methods of political science, in which we study causal processes or universal principles or canonical institutions, which, as Jim puts it, effectively stop those who study politics from seeing their work as a discussion with their fellow citizens as equals. The normal methods of political science make it one of the most constitute some of the most sophisticated forms of prejudgment. So what I find so encouraging and inspiring about his latest work is that he calls on political scientists to reject these elitist practices. Political science has to bridge academic research and the everyday civic struggles of democratic citizens. Political science researchers have to be in conversation with fellow citizens. I want to highlight one of the ways he describes this in summing up, in coming to, I'm going to try to come to a conclusion here. He says in the chapter 8 of Public Philosophy, volume 2, he talks about how policymakers lack the courage and the humility to turn to the dialogical, practical wisdom of citizens for guidance. The courage and the humility. And I think this raises a number of really important questions for those of us who teach political science and practice political science. Since theorists, courts, and policymakers are in fact citizens, what he's talking about is powerful citizens. So why don't powerful citizens listen to the rest of us? And where can they get the courage and the humility, to use his words, to do so? And if ordinary citizens are ignored, how do we ensure that they'll continue to have the patience, that they will have the humility, that they will have the courage to build and sustain a society which values dissent, nonviolent dissent, that fosters ongoing conversation, and with which citizens will continue to identify? How can we as citizens guarantee that the ordinary everyday negotiations that we participate in are not subverted or manipulated or ignored or overridden by media oligarchies and unscrupulous politicians, or unscrupulous politicians who are media oligarchs, for that matter, or misguided, well-meaning courts? How can citizens acquire and maintain the skills to speak to each other with a genuine willingness to compromise and learn from each other? Now, Jim has an important answer to this, and the answer is by practice, and that includes the practice of peaceful civic dissent. When they don't listen, we go out into the streets. That's our right. And as someone who's organized dissent in the past, and possibly in the future, I can't promise I won't, I would like to emphasize that I'm very sympathetic to his argument. But what I want to do is I want to emphasize another possible answer to some of these questions that his scholarship and his teaching alludes to. He's talking about, you know, where do we get the virtues that come with these practices? And I think the idea that virtues come, the virtues that come with practice are dispositions that come from ongoing practice, is an important critical argument that, you know, through practice we acquire the dispositions of courage. I want to emphasize, though, that they also begin in apprenticeship, in teaching. So the point I want to make is that in order to fully realize the possibility of a society built on valuing dissent, in which all citizens have the humility and courage to listen to each other, a good place to start is the educational curriculum and the practice of teaching. There's a role for educating citizens, that is, inculcating moral values. There's an essential role for good teachers as role models who can communicate easily with students these virtues. Now, this is, of course, an ancient idea. One example of this, which is fresh in my mind, comes from the great Roman Stoic Seneca, whose letters Jim always had on his reading list, and whose letters I've recently come to appreciate even more. He tells us, Seneca, that virtues like courage and humility are not qualities that come from the acquaintance with books. What makes us courageous is the perseverance of constant daily practice through regular training of self-control, self-scrutiny, and the care of ourself. However, there was also in his explanation a role for education, and especially for philosophy. Philosophy makes us free. Philosophy makes us wise, and a wise person acquires the strength of character. There was an important role in his explanation for the liberal arts. Moral values have to be learned, and the liberal arts prepare the mind for their acquisition. Now, as I'm sure you know, what I'm describing is also the pedagogical philosophy of Renaissance humanism, another historical moment that Jim cites prominently as an inspiration for his approach, and it evident in this catchphrase that we find throughout his writings, Audi alteram partem. The essential aspect of classical humanist tradition was a philosophy of education centered on the teaching of letter writing and the art of public speaking. Over 700 years ago, a foundational moment of political science emerged when civic humanists mobilized these skills for very practical purposes, as a bulwark against tyranny, to protect freedom and self-government. And this is reflected in a number of famous authors. Perhaps among the first authors to think of himself with complete self-consciousness as a political scientist, Quentin Skinner reminds us in his Foundations of Political Thought, was Brunetto Latini, who wrote in the 13th century. He saw a close connection between good government, the maintenance of a free society, and a certain kind of education focused on the sciences of speaking and writing well. He wrote, "The chief science in relation to the government of cities is that of rhetoric, that is, the science of speech." Now, as far as contemporary political science is concerned, all this belongs in the dustbin of history. And I would respectfully submit that this is one of the problems of contemporary political science. We don't have required courses in political science on the art of negotiation, on public speaking. In fact, when I ask my students, where do you learn to speak well, they tell me in business school, in law school, and in a school of dramatic arts. And yet, political science was the place that students originally learned how to speak to a wider audience. And so for lots of reasons, political science departments today are failing to properly educate students in the practices not only of negotiation, but of peaceful, nonviolent protest. And students are craving to learn histories and practices of peaceful, nonviolent protest. A few minutes. The point is that this is all extracurricular for political science. It's not the essential role of a political science to enter into dialogue with the wider audience of citizens. The dominant way of thinking is to see public engagement as something extra that does nothing to advance knowledge and understanding, or worse, public engagement is a frivolous distraction from the real research that we're doing. The dominant way of thinking in political science is that scholars should write for other specialists, because that's how knowledge advances. And that's the issue that I think Jim Tully's important work raises. What he means when he says that political scientists have become disconnected from the ordinary daily practices of everyday life. If we take seriously his concept of dialogue and public philosophy, I think it has profoundly important implications for political science. If our aim is to understand political practices, our duty as scholars, as professors, is not just to listen to each other, but to listen and learn from a larger audience inside the classroom and outside the classroom, avoiding a culture that glorifies arcane unintelligibility, that disdains public impact. Our curriculum has to change. Political science has to train students not just how to recognize dependent and independent variables or the basic principles of formal logic, which are still required courses in political science and philosophy. We also need to teach students how to listen, communicate, and disagree. The arts of negotiation, the techniques of conflict resolution. And some of this, actually, is to go back to what political science was for some 700 years, returning to the classical curriculum of rhetoric. How to write a letter, how to express oneself for a newspaper opinion, how to organize a non-violent protest. These should be requirements of political science. Not electives, not just study cases of political struggles that are classic, like Mandela or Gandhi or Martin Luther King, but to study Idle No More, to take seriously the student protests that have been taking place in Quebec, to pay attention to the current struggle to bring attention to murdered and missing Aboriginal women. These should be required courses in political science, like those courses that force us to learn what dependent and independent variables are. And the university institution has a responsibility to foster and encourage communication with a wider audience. And that means hiring good teachers, not just good researchers. So this is the lesson of that anecdote, because dialogue is not something that Jim Tully just talks about. It's something he does, and he does very well as a teacher and a public intellectual. It's not important for him to be a disengaged theorist imposing terms of debate on participants, but to actually participate in public dialogue with his students and with the wider audience. And I think if we take seriously his concept of dialogue and public philosophy and his criticisms of political science, I think these are some of the implications. I think what's remarkable, just to finish, what's remarkable about his scholarship is that he wants us to reconsider what we normally call political science, how we practice and teach political science. It's not a disengaged elitist discipline, but an engaged democratic practice. Political explanations and solutions are always negotiable. They're always provisional and partial. And without general theories or causal variables, we can still know and understand the real world and each other, because politics is a dialogical science. Thank you. And sorry, sincerely, for going over the time.